Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. After the November election, virtually every statewide and legislative leader said the time had come to make major changes in the way that Vermonters pay for education. And yet since that time, only one major plan has emerged at the State House. It's a proposal that shifts more of the burden for financing schools onto the income tax. Bristol Representative Dave Sharp is the chairman of the House Education Committee. He says the plan has a lot of promise, but he says there are a lot of details that need to be worked out.
We're going to continue moving down that path, and I would love to bring one to the floor, but we have to find numbers that work in the bill. You know, the concept is wonderful, but when you get into the details, it gets tough.
This plan work, and why do its supporters think it's an improvement over the current system? These are some of the questions today for our guest, two sponsors of that legislation, Londonderry Representative Oliver Olson and Colchester Representative Jim Condon. I'd like to welcome both of you to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be here.
And you can join the conversation here. What are your thoughts about the way that Vermonters pay for education? Is the current system pretty good, or does it need to be changed? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Maybe you want to change the system. How would you change it? 1-800-639-2211. So as we begin this discussion, let's see if we can very briefly run through how the current system works in its most basic form. I know that it does take a rocket scientist to understand this, but we're going to try to boil it down to its most simple form. And then once we understand that, we can see how the two of you would like to change it and why you want to change it. So, Representative Olson, I know there are many different classifications of taxpayers, but let's look at three major ones. And the first one would be, these are residential property taxpayers who pay their full school tax. How many people fall in that category? What percentage of people do you think?
Thank you, Bob. It's roughly 35% of residential property owners pay the full penny rate. So they're paying the full property tax bill. They do not benefit from the income sensitivity program.
And then, as you just mentioned, we have people who participate in the income sensitivity program. We're going to get to that a little bit later, but that's about 65 or 70%?
Correct.
And then finally, we have non-residential taxpayers. How are they treated?
So non-residential taxpayers, those are businesses, second homeowners. It could be a camp, a second home on the lake. Any of that property is basically taxed at a uniform level statewide and is not subject to town-to-town differences in school spending.
So why was that put in? Because we see from town to town, we see the tax rate fluctuates depending on the per-pupil spending in those communities. But for non-residential, that's not a factor.
Correct. And that came about as part of Act 68. And at that point, the grand list was separated into residential homeowners and all non-residential property. And that was done for a few reasons. One is it provides a very stable source of revenue from year to year. It also recognizes that non-residential property owners, you know, whether it's business owners or second homeowners, they are not actually participating in those budgeting decisions. They're not making spending decisions. So the concept is we're still going to tax them, but it's going to be a uniform rate across the state.
Okay. Representative Condon, we're going to just use some numbers that are easy to multiply and divide by.
Good. I like that, Bob.
Yeah, definitely works
multiply,
for me.
Right?
So right now the state provides each community with a base amount of money. It's roughly $9,300 per student in their school system. Most towns have a larger per pupil spending rate, and the additional money is raised with the local property tax. This gets added on to the statewide property tax rate. Is there a simple way of describing how that statewide property tax rate gets set?
There's no simple way to describe it, Bob, and this is one of the reasons we've proposed this legislation. If you tried to come up with the most convoluted way to pay for education in the state of Vermont, then you'd be happy with our current system. You know, it's been described as a Rube Goldberg contraption. It's Byzantine. And when people go to vote in their school districts on town meeting day, are they clear on what the connection is between what they're spending locally and what their tax rate is going to be? They're not, because they can't be. It's too complicated. So that's one of the reasons we've proposed the legislation we have. I mean, we start off with estimates on what the total statewide education spending is going to be. This is something that the Agency of Education puts together and tries to guesstimate through interactions with the school boards and all the different districts. Then we, the legislature sets a per pupil base amount. This is something that's supposed, under statute, is supposed to be a, it's supposed to grow by a certain amount each year, except when it doesn't, which has happened in the past. Then we have an education base rate that we set. That's what the legislature is involved in. Keep in mind, there are a lot of people who still believe that somehow this is a categorical grant coming to the districts from the state. That's not the way this works. Everyone in their school districts votes on their budget, whatever it is. It ranges from a low of right around the base amount of like $9,300 in Brighton, for instance. They spend the base amount up to $18,000, $20,000 per student. It varies from district to district. Well, all that money goes into one big pot. It's then up to the state to determine what the base rate's going to be to try to raise that money, which can then be sent to the towns. So it's convoluted, and that doesn't even get to the matter of what your tax rate is going to be. That's just how the money total is determined. Everyone gets what they vote for. And so there are towns that are spending money that other towns then have to pay for, because the base rate has to come up to pay for all of these budgets. And so it's a complex way of doing business. And that doesn't get into, you know, how you actually establish what your personal tax rate is going to be.
So let's just take an example. You mentioned the base amount of $9,300 a student. Let's say my town spends 50% more per pupil than the base amount. So that's roughly $14,000 per student. And let's just say, to make the math nice and easy, the statewide property tax rate is a dollar. Can I basically say, since my town is spending 50% more above the base rate, that my spending or my property tax rate will be 150% of the statewide rate?
You're close.
Okay.
Generally.
Yeah.
However, there is a common level of appraisal. In other words, the value of your homestead, how does that relate to similar properties in other towns? How close are you to 100% of valuation, true homestead value? That determines your CLA, or your common level of appraisal, and that affects your tax rate as well, usually upwards. And when it gets out of whack by too much, the town has to reappraise.
And that's considered to be kind of a fairness provision, because if you live in a town that hasn't had an appraisal in 5 years, the value of that property is probably artificially low.
Yes, that's right. And that's why they also use a 3-year rolling average for the CLA, just to make things a little more complex.
So, Representative Olson, I think a lot of people focus on how much is my school budget going up this year, and they see, oh, look at that. It's going up 2.5%. It seems reasonable to them, and that's the number that they focus on, when they really should be focusing on how does that affect the per pupil spending. So explain to us why that's important.
Thank you, Bob. And I'm actually on a mission to try to change this conversation. And it's, I find it really amazing. Every time I pick up the newspaper and I read about a school budget increasing or even being level funded, I'm always amazed at how left out of the conversation is the per pupil spending number. And when folks back at home are concerned about their property tax rates and what's happening with property tax rates, they really need to be focusing in on what the per pupil number is. How much is the school proposing to spend on a per pupil basis? Because that is the number that actually drives the tax rate, not the budget itself. So, for example, you could have a school budget that year over year is level funded, but if that school is experiencing a decline in student enrollment, the per pupil number is going to go up. So your taxes are going to go up. And I know a lot of people are very confused when they read in the newspaper that the budget has been level funded, yet their taxes are going up, and that creates a lot of frustration and angst.
Let's go to a couple of callers and start off with John in Montgomery. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I, as a financial advisor, would advise clients if their income is down to cut their spending. And our population of students is down 20%, and yet no one really seems to want to address that issue in the legislature, much less the local school board. And it's not so much of, and my concern would be not so much how we're getting the school funding done, it's that the school funding is too big to begin with. So my question is, what's it going to take in the way of news from the local taxpayers for the legislature to address the fact that school funding needs to be appropriate relative to the number of students in the system? And that gets into a lot of conversation that took place yesterday, but how we get the funding is one thing. And more importantly, we need to address the fact that we need to cut the funding by at least 10-20% to be appropriate.
John, I'm not going to disagree with you. You're right. And the legislature in years past has instituted an excess spending penalty on the towns, where if you're a certain percentage, I think it was 25%. We've lowered that a little bit now, then your town, your district is going to pay more per student. And that has not obviously done the job. There have been ideas that maybe there should be an excess staffing penalty, trying to get us back to more in line with national averages. As you know, we're one of the smallest teacher-student ratios in the country right now. And obviously that's a major factor in the expense.
And Representative Olson, you want to sort of attack this spending side as well as how the money is raised.
Absolutely. I mean, John's comment is spot on. You know, fundamentally, we have a spending problem, as has been said by many, including the governor, and I couldn't agree more. Part of that spending problem, I would argue, is driven by the sheer complexity of the system. And we effectively have a funding system today where everyone is responsible for those spending decisions, yet no one is responsible because it is just so confusing. So I think we need to, first of all, create some more transparency around spending and how we're funding schools. But in the meantime, we're approaching crisis stage here from a spending perspective. So actually, Representative Condon and I and others have just this week actually introduced some legislation that would create a statewide cap on the growth rate of education here in Vermont, with a variable cap on the growth rate of per pupil spending on a district-by-district basis for 3 fiscal years, the intent being that this would create a bridge that would allow some time for larger structural reforms to take effect. As you know, the House Education Committee is working on some structural reforms to our education system, but this is like steering a battleship. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. So the intention of this other legislation we've introduced is to provide that bridge to help moderate the growth in spending.
Today in the program, we're looking at some changes to the way that Vermont pays for education. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to look at this new plan and why the two sponsors here feel that it's an improvement. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at a new plan and how Vermont funds education. With us, two sponsors of the bill, Colchester Representative Jim Condon and also Londonderry Representative Oliver Olson. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. So, Representative Olson, we've got an idea of how the current system works. It's very complicated. How would you like to change it? How could you improve it?
Thanks, Bob. So the starting point for this is we'd like to get to a system where when voters walk in to town meeting and they want to know how a school budget is going to impact their tax rate, we want there to be a common, consistent answer. We want a system that is uniform in its impact on the taxes. So that is the guiding principle behind this system. If we can get to a point where everyone is taxed in substantially the same manner, it's much easier, it becomes much easier to explain. So what we're attempting to do under this proposal is to keep the non-residential property tax in place. So that would provide a nice stable base of revenue. We would dramatically lower the residential property tax. We would still have a residential property tax, but it would now be fixed. It would be a uniform level across the state. And then we would make up for the difference in revenue with a variable income tax. And the concept is very simply stated, your variable income tax would be set based on your per pupil spending within your particular district. So the more you spend on a per pupil basis, the higher that education income tax would be. The less you spend, the lower it would be.
Now, the beauty of this is that it would simplify the system greatly, and we'd be getting rid of the cliff, which is the $90,000 over-under, whether you qualify for income sensitivity or not. That would vanish. It would all be completely income sensitized. It would get rid of the property tax rebate, prebate, credit system that's changed in various ways over the years, because people would be paying a much lower rate on their property to begin with. We would be able to collect about $145 million less in taxes off the top that currently then get redistributed. We wouldn't have to do that. So it would make it a lot simpler to understand, because when you have a system like that we have now that virtually no one can explain, how can it possibly be fair to then ask people to vote on a budget when they can't determine what impact it's going to have on them personally? Is simply not fair.
So if you want to use the income tax as a important part of this whole thing, some of our listeners might be thinking, why don't you just use the income tax altogether? Why even hold on to any element of a property tax? Let's go to a totally income-based system.
Well, it's because there's some stability with the property tax, more so than with income tax collections, which is much more volatile year to year. I mean, we're actually seeing some of that right now as our current income tax receipts seem to be dwindling. So keeping a balance, a fairer balance between the property tax and the income tax would be the object of this legislation.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Richmond. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi there, and hello to your guests. I'd like to learn more about the details of this, but my question and comment is about, if you look back 30 years, we've had multiple funding revisions, from Morris Giuliani to Act 60 to Act 68 and so on. What I haven't heard in the discussion up till now has anything to do with the student, which is ultimately what we're trying to deal with here. And what we haven't talked about and don't seem to talk about is how we deliver the education and whether what we're delivering is appropriate and how do we measure that. Now, I appreciate that the funding piece is a significant portion of it, but it's not the only portion. And I guess I throw it out to the legislators, but also ask them to look to their colleagues and say, you know, other than a little bit of discussion about governance, we're not talking about what we're delivering and whether we're doing a good job delivering it. And then look at cost and how we spend. The person who says cut 10%, you might be cutting muscle as opposed to be cutting fat. And you don't know if you don't look at the system. Thanks.
Thanks, Ron.
Thanks, John. I think it's an excellent point, and I would argue that the House Education Committee has actually had a lot of focus on this subject. That, you know, I think the goal here is, you know, part of their broader structural reform efforts. They're looking at how can we take the resources that we have today, and we have substantial resources in the system, monetary resources. How do we put those to more effective use so that we're providing better, even better opportunities for our students? And we have a number of examples, and the Secretary of Education, I think, has done a phenomenal job sort of illustrating the point where we have students in one district that's, you know, say, spending $15,000 per pupil that can barely provide even basic educational opportunities to students, while other districts that are spending basically the same amount of money are able to provide much greater opportunities. That's a very big part of the conversation they're having in the House Education Committee as we speak, and that is really part of the broader system reform effort that they're looking at.
Let's talk to Arthur, who is calling from Shrewsbury. Hi, Arthur. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm a former school board member, and one of the problems you have, especially in small towns, is funding special ed. You don't know from one year to the next what your special ed needs are going to be. They vary widely. In one year in Shrewsbury, we were spending about 10% of the budget on one student, and you have to pay the special ed no matter what, and then you figure out the rest of your budget. So I think it would be much better if the state took the special ed funding over directly, since the local school boards have no control whatsoever of it, and it would be a lot easier to figure out the local budget.
Arthur, I agree with you. I agree with you on that, and you know, we've had a series of different mandates over the years that the state imposes or the federal government imposes that the local districts wind up paying for. They have to include these things in their budget, and obviously special ed is a huge part of that. You know, there would be maybe a little more bureaucracy on the top if the state did take it over, but I think you're right that that's probably the most efficient way to go.
Let's talk to Minnie in Peacham. Hi, Minnie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Love your show. My wife and I are retired public school teachers with many, many years of experience behind us, and we don't really understand all the complexities of this funding issue, but we hope that the decision makers will keep two fundamental ideas in mind as they go forward. Number one is you get what you pay for. Fund public education well, and you'll get good results. Look at the well-endowed independent schools, St. Johnsbury Academy, Burr & Burton, prep schools. And those schools don't have to take all the students who come through their doors, as public schools proudly do, special ed students and students with other tough issues. I grew up in Hanover, New Hampshire in the 50s and 60s, and it was they did a good job because it was well-funded. Still, many of the kids from there went off to prep schools, but the town paid $0 toward that. If parents want to send their kids away from the public school offered, that's fine, but public funds should not be spent on that. And in all of our years in public education, we never saw waste of any kind that was of any significance as far as using the money. And the second idea is that income is a huge problem now. Education in Vermont does an awful lot well by all measures. Don't ruin it. Public education isn't expensive. It's just unaffordable because of the poor policies related to the middle class and poor incomes at this time and outlandish insurance. There's plenty of money in, for us to keep our good small schools. Progressive taxing will find it. And I will take your comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Olson?
Yes, thank you for the comment. I actually happen to serve on the Board of Trustees at Burr & Burton Academy, so I think it's important to point out because there can be a misconception about this. Although Burr & Burton and St. Johnsbury as well are independent academies, both schools actually take all comers. All students are accepted, including those with some fairly extreme special needs.
You know, last year on Town Meeting Day, I think about 35 school districts rejected their budgets, and people thought it was a crisis. Now, some people might look at that and say, well, you know, that was about 10% of all the budgets that were voted on that day. So 90% passed, 10% went down. Some people think, you know, this is democracy in action. This is the way it's supposed to work. This is a way for local taxpayers to say to their school boards, you're spending the right amount or you're spending too much. So if that's the case, Representative Olson, you know, why do we need to change things?
Well, I think if 10% of school budgets are failing, that's 10% too many. That's a clear signal that voters are out there, they're frustrated, and they're looking for change. And I would argue even those in those districts where they pass their budget, there's an people support their schools and they support their school budgets. People do not want to vote down their school budget, but they're frustrated by the system. And I think we have a responsibility as a legislature to acknowledge that and to take some action.
I mean, look, we had 35 towns vote down their budgets, including mine, twice. And they wanted to send a message to Montpelier. Even the city of Montpelier sent a message to Montpelier as they voted down their school budget. A lot of people saw their tax rates go up despite spending, in some cases, being flat. And people were, how can that be? It's because of the complexity of this of the current funding system. And that's what our legislation is aimed to address. You know, of course, the quality of the education, you know, the child always, you know, comes first. Are we delivering a quality education to our youth? And that's of course is an overriding concern. But can we do both? Can we deliver high quality education in a fairer, more understandable way, so that when people go to town meeting day, they'll have a clearer idea of what they're voting on and how it's going to affect them?
So let's just say hypothetically that 10 days from now, when folks go to vote on their school budgets in many communities, let's just say 15 or 16 budgets go down, something that is more the normal average than what happened last year. Does that seem to indicate people saying crisis? What crisis?
Well, maybe. it may say that. But I think if you saw 15 or 16 budgets go down, as Representative Olson said, that's, you know, 15 or 16 too many. Why were they voted down? Because the taxes keep going up. The number of students being educated goes down. The number of faculty goes up. How can that all make sense? And then even if your spending goes down, your tax rate goes up and you're paying more in taxes, it's a nutty system.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Monica in South Burlington. Hi, Monica. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Yes. Hi, Jim. I'm a South Burlington resident.
Hi, Monica.
I am always baffled by trying to understand how this all works myself. Can you guys please explain how this new idea that you have would change anything in how the perception that larger towns are helping cover expenses of some smaller towns while these larger towns are facing things like strikes and budget cuts and such things?
Well, it's a good question, Monica. In some cases, larger towns are, you know, helping other towns pay their bills. And sometimes the smaller towns with more money are helping the larger towns with less money pay theirs, like Burlington, for instance. So it's kind of a mix on that one. But how do we think our legislation would help help make that clearer to people? Is that the question?
Yes. Will this bring clarity to that? Because I do think, to your point, sometimes budgets can seem to almost remain flat, or people don't understand the changes, yet it seems like the tax is just always going up, like there's a disconnect.
Yeah, well, a lot of that has to do with the property tax rates. And by relying less on that, it should be more stable across the board. I mean, right now we have some school districts are spending $9,500, the base amount for their students, while other districts are spending $20,000 per pupil. And that doesn't get into the 700 phantom students we have, which could probably dedicate a whole nother hour to explain what that's all about. So there's a wide variety, and I'm not sure we're actually in that as far as the Brigham decision and its effect on equal opportunity for educational opportunity for Vermont's youth, I'm not sure we're in compliance right now because districts are voting whatever they want to vote, and other towns have to help pick up the tab. It all goes into one big bucket, if your budget passes, then, you know, you're going to have your money. The state right now isn't saying, sorry, we're not going to give you that. It's too much. That's not the way it works right now. It's the local control. And locally, people are making the decisions to support increased budgets.
So I think, you know, one of the things that's going around, there's actually been an analogy kicking around for a few years. It's the dinner analogy. And it goes something like this. If you were to get together with a group of your friends and your neighbors, let's say 100 of you, and you all decided to go to a banquet hall for dinner, and you were given a menu, and at the beginning of the meal, it was announced that the bill would be split evenly across all of the people eating dinner. And you look around and you see that the other guests seated at the table are ordering steak and bottles of expensive wine. And you were planning on something of a more modest meal, but you know that the bill is going to be split evenly. You're going to do the same thing. There's no incentive to keep to keep the costs under control.
Today in the program, we're looking at the way that the state pays for education, and we're looking at a proposal that would change that. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you have an idea about this, we certainly would enjoy hearing from you. What about ideas? How about a statewide teacher's contract, or having all teachers have health care on a statewide basis, and maybe even having the state pay that statewide teacher's expense, take that away? That's about 75% of the local school budget.
Well, I think the concept of having the state take over health care benefits and the expense of that, I think, is a really intriguing one, actually, Bob. Particularly since we have a big issue that's coming down the pipe with as part of the Affordable Care Act. There's something known as the Cadillac tax, which is an excise tax on high value health insurance plans, of which many public school employees are part of. So we have a structural problem we're going to have to deal with. So I think there's an opportunity for the state to take over funding of health care in an effort to get ahead of this excise tax, for one, and look at that as an opportunity to control cost.
And I remember when Ralph Wright first proposed a statewide teacher's contract way back, there are some real difficulties with that. It's not as easy to implement as you'd think. Do you put everyone at the same salary level across the state, or do you have regional differences, either by county or north, south, east, west? How do you do that? The bottom line is, actually, we'd probably be spending a lot more money than we are now. So it's a little tricky. If it were in effect right now, it'd be great. State of Hawaii does it, for instance. They've got a statewide teacher's contract. But to implement that from right now would be an expensive proposition. I've got one other alternative bill, if I can mention it quickly, Bob. This would create a $100,000 exemption on the value of your homestead for the purposes of determining your statewide education tax. That $100,000 exemption, however, would be lowered by the amount of your district's overspending vis-a-vis the base amount. So the more your town spends, the less of an exemption you would get. And that might have an influence on spending, but also would provide immediate property tax relief.
So, Representative Olson, what's the next step here? People are listening to this. Some people may find this intriguing. Some people may have a lot of questions about it. How do you see this unfolding? Is this a two-year process?
At least, Bob. You know, I think any major structural reform to our system, whether it's to governance, spending, funding, is going to be a multi-year process. I think there are steps that we can take to move the ball forward this year, to start the conversation, to study this further. As Chairman Sharp mentioned, you know, the devil's in the details, and it takes time to get something like this right. But we have to get the conversation started, and that's why Representative Connan and I and others have put forward actually several proposals to deal with both spending and the funding side of the equation, in addition to the governance proposals under consideration.
We've been talking with Representative Oliver Olson and Representative Jim Condon about their plan to change the way that Vermont pays for education. Many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up next, I'll talk with VPR's Pete Hirschfeld about the stalemate between the Shumlin administration and the State Employees Union. This week, state employees held a rally at the State House to protest a plan by the Shumlin administration to renegotiate their existing contract in order to make at least $5 million in savings for the coming year. Those savings could come in the form of higher health care payments for state employees or a reduction of their proposed salary increases. With us now to take a look at this story is VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Hey, Pete.
Hey, Bob.
So it seems like the State Employees Union is pretty darn clear. They do not want to reopen this contract. So what's this about?
Bob, they just don't feel like this is their problem to solve. A bunch of state workers packed into the House chamber on Tuesday, and one of their leaders said that the budget crisis, quote, does not constitute an emergency on our part or obligate us to open up a contract we already bargained in good faith. They say that the working class men and women who inspect our elevators, process our driver's licenses, plow our roads, or administer our human services can't afford the kind of cuts that the administration is proposing. They also think that there are other ways to solve this problem without going after the salary and benefits of middle-class workers. Instead of hitting those folks, they want Peter Shumlin and the legislature to look at Vermonters making considerably more money than they are, whether that's increasing the marginal rate for the highest income earners in the state or getting rid of some of the income tax deductions that rich people use to lower their tax bills. The union says there are people who can much more easily afford to pay a little more into the public till.
So help me remember, have state employees for the most part had level funded salaries for the last couple of years?
No, they've actually gotten raises in each of the last 3 years, I believe. But they did absorb a hit to their salaries as Vermont was coming out of the Great Recession. In 2010, the legislature passed a budget that relied on a 3% cut to state worker salaries. That was a negotiation in which the union also agreed to a pay freeze through 2012. Union officials say they have done their job helping out and that the sacrifice that they made then needs to be honored now.
So it seems like the Shumlin administration is playing hardball here. I mean, their message seems to be, okay, if you don't want to reopen the labor contract, then you leave us no choice but to lay off as many as 400 employees. Is this a bargaining threat? Is it a reality? How do you view this and how is it being viewed at the State House?
It's hard to say whether that's a bluff or not. Certainly layoffs of that magnitude are a doomsday scenario for labor, and the administration throws that figure out there to underscore for the VSEA just how severe the potential losses could be and how serious it is about achieving those payroll savings. But it's also part of this public negotiation where both sides are trying to win the support of the general public, trying to sway public opinion toward their side. And administration officials point out that the average compensation package for a state worker is about $85,000. Now, that's a number that includes your pension, your health care, all kinds of other benefits. But for any Vermonter making less than that, and that is the majority of us, it's a figure that probably sounds more than fair to them. The administration says it would much rather save those jobs and get the VSEA to, say, agree to forego the 2.5% increase that union workers are slated to get next year. And the threat of layoffs is they hope, one way of getting them to the bargaining table.
So how do you see this whole dispute getting settled? Will lawmakers insist on these savings, or will they look in other places to try to come up with $5 million?
The VSEA is having a very tough time finding any support for its cause in Montpelier right now. House Speaker Shap Smith, Senate President John Campbell both say that reductions in government payroll are an absolutely necessary component to solving this $112 million shortfall in the general fund budget. And if the VSEA is going to win this fight, then it's going to have to find some pretty hard-hitting lawmakers to take up its cause and fast.
Let's look at another key issue at the State House, and that's the governor's plan to impose a 0.7% payroll tax on all businesses in the state. That tax would raise roughly $90 million, and this money would be matched by roughly $100 million in federal money. Now, the idea is to take $140 million of this and put it into an effort to raise the Medicaid reimbursement rate and thereby reduce the cost shift that takes place when government drastically underfunds the cost of Medicaid services. Do you have a sense that this plan is in trouble at the State House?
Views are still evolving, but the plan is definitely in trouble. The concept of a payroll tax is an incendiary one, and most business groups absolutely hate it. And while the hit to the average business wouldn't be enormous under this plan, we're talking about a few hundred dollars a year for very small companies. A lot of people view it as a dangerous precedent and view the payroll tax as a place that administrations are going to continue to go to every time they have a need for revenue.
So now the governor says if lawmakers go ahead with this plan, the net result will be a 5% reduction in private health care premiums next year. And that some people don't believe the link is all that strong. And the governor says, I'll prove it to you. I'll put a provision in the bill that says if it's not 5%, this whole payroll tax gets sunsetted. Is that a winning strategy?
This idea from the governor is more, I think, about political salesmanship on Shumlin's part than it is about the creation of sound policy. I don't think lawmakers are going to get bogged down trying to come up with some kind of twisted methodology where they have to figure out who's getting what back. They're going to evaluate the proposal on its merits and then move forward or not. But it underscores the basic tension at play here. Peter Shumlin says the economic harm to businesses that would come in the form of the payroll tax will be offset entirely by the economic benefits of the lower health insurance premiums that they'll enjoy as a result. And the bottom line is that many legislators remain unconvinced that that will be the outcome, pledges from the governor notwithstanding.
So do you think most lawmakers at this point want to address the Medicaid cost shift? They see that as a serious issue, but they're not so sure the payroll tax is the way that they want to finance it?
They absolutely want to do something about this cost shift. They have for a long time. The issue, though, has always been the money. The state last year was going to spend $10 million to boost Medicaid rates. That was going to get them up by 3%. They were going to be paying providers 3% more this year to treat Medicaid patients than they were the prior year. But when revenues came in under target, the first place that they went to were those increased Medicaid rates. It's just been a place where there's been a professed commitment to improve Medicaid rates without any willingness to come through with the revenue needed to accomplish that.
So we're about a week away from the town meeting week break for lawmakers, kind of the halfway point through the session. Is it going to come to a point where they're going to have to start making some decisions pretty quickly on this?
Yeah. And there's a threshold question that lawmakers have to ask. Do we want to address the cost shift or not? If we do want to address it, then by how much? That's the question that they need to find the answer to, and soon. Once we know the answer to that, then we can expect a long, drawn-out process as they decide to figure out how they want to pay for it. If there's no appetite for the payroll tax, well, you've got the proposed tax on soda and sugar-sweetened beverages out there. You've got some people who want to increase taxes only on businesses that don't provide health insurance to their employees. So are there any number of ways they could raise this money? The thing they need to decide first is, do we want to find the money? Then they get to answer the question, where do we get it?
We'll be following this as this whole thing unfolds. VPR's Pete Hirschfeld, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
That is our program for today. Join us Monday on Vermont Edition when we take up the issue of childhood vaccines. Should Vermont tighten the rules on who can opt out of getting vaccinated? And how do we weigh the right of individuals to make healthcare choices against protecting public health? It's a controversial topic. That's Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Sangari. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.